from the Sky News Centre at 5. David Cameron has accused campaigners who want to leave the European Union of promoting a vision that's simply too good to be true. The Prime Minister's warning a vote for withdrawal would endanger trade and jobs. Earlier, Boris Johnson gave his first big speech since announcing he'll campaign for an exit. Speaking at a Vote Leave event in Kent, he said a vote to quit the EU is a win-win for everyone.
I think it's time to ignore the pessimists and the merchants of gloom and to do a new deal that would be good for Britain and good for Europe too.
Police say they are stopping up to 4 planned dissident Republican attacks for every one the terrorists managed to pull off. Officers are warning of widening capabilities ranging from car bombs to rocket-fired grenades. Detectives say they need more community help in thwarting the threat. Will Kerr, Assistant Chief Constable with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, says the threat remains very real.
There are several hundred active dissident Republican suspects at the moment and a significantly smaller number than that who have very significant terrorist experience who are involved in leading and directing those groups.
Around 3,500 people in Derbyshire have been told not to use their water supply because of abnormal chlorine levels. Severn Trent says it's a precautionary measure while it investigates a service reservoir. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump has secured the support of his former rival Ben Carson. Carson, who dropped out of the race last week, made the endorsement at a rally in Florida. In football, Newcastle have appointed Rafa Benitez as their new manager, hours after sacking Steve McClaren as head coach. The former Liverpool boss takes over a club in the Premier League's relegation zone. And an animal thought to be a giant rat has been found near a children's playground in East London. The rodent, believed to be 4 feet long, was discovered dead in Hackney by a gas engineer. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
With BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Clifton councillor and Conservative candidate for Mayor, Charles Lucas. Charles will be calling in about 20 minutes, half an hour. But until then, we have the company of Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news in the week, the Beatles producer George Martin died, we have a look at another Beatle whose time was not allowed to run its course. The brains behind the band, John Lennon, assassinated in New York in 1980 under a US intelligence program called Counterintelligence Propaganda, or COINTELPRO for short. We find out what John Lennon thought about voting for mayors. Also, the final English film by one of Britain's greatest ever comedians, Rick Mayall. Why has it still not been shown in cinemas or on British television? Could it be because Rick plays a character with controversial views about the war on terror? The British establishment don't want us to see. Also, the Turkish government send the police in to take over the country's biggest opposition paper, which just happens to be publishing evidence of the president's corruption. We hear from the English edition's executive editor. Plus, 2 big anniversaries of great British cover-ups this week. It's 30 years since the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and 20 since the Dunblane murders of 20 Scottish primary school children and their teachers by paedophile suspect Thomas Hamilton, who overruled police advice for him to have his gun licences taken away. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. And news after 6. Onto the news review in a minute, though, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, dry with frost and fog. This weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, mainly cloudy with some sunny spells on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs 11, plenty of sunshine this week with the occasional shower and some gusty winds at times. Next weekend, the 19th and 20th of March, highs are again around 11 Celsius with sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. So helping us review this week's news in a little while will be Charles Lucas from the Conservatives, standing for Mayor. Up until that time, we're going to have to make do with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Good evening.
First of all, I think we should just take a look at some of the, I suppose for me, a really important story this week, which has got very little coverage, and that is the BBC, the Director General Tony Hall, has issued a warning about the BBC's independence. Proposals to allow greater government say over the running of the BBC risk it being seen as a state broadcaster. BBC Director General Tony Hall has said his comments follow an independent, inverted commas, review which recommends replacing the BBC Trust with the Board of Directors, half appointed by government ministers. Well, I can remember there was a BBC board before the BBC Trust, and now they want to go back to a board again.
Well, I mean, obviously, the BBC isn't perfect, but it's certainly a lot better than the multiple channels of rubbish that we have in the United States of America provided by the private sector. And, of course, it provides an important counterweight to the privately run media in this country, which are overwhelmingly to the right
but
on
no,
the economic
hang on.
Issues.
It's the other way around, isn't it? Actually, it's privately run Channel 4 News, which is which I would say is better than the BBC.
Well, but Channel 4 itself is not entirely a private sector operation, is it?
Well, no, it's they're talking about privatising Channel 4.
Indeed they are. So, in other words, preserving the public service ethos of broadcasting in Britain has never been more important. That doesn't mean that either Channel 4 News or the BBC or even ourselves here at BCFM should be regarded as above criticism.
I wonder, though, because you know what's happened generally in the public sector is a lot of public provision, state provision, has been replaced over the years by kind of charitable bodies, NGO kind of community sector groups that have subsequently then had their funding taken away, or they found that because of 2008 they're not getting charitable donations because there's far less money going to charity from return on interest for foundations and things like that, and so that a lot of that has been allowed to collapse, whereas it would have been very embarrassing for the government if they'd have just switched off public services directly. What they've done is they've done a two-stage process. They've handed stuff over to the charitable and voluntary sector, and then the charitable and voluntary sector have found it more and more difficult to cope. And I wonder whether maybe the similar sort of thing going on in broadcasting, where, oh, well, we've got all these wonderful community radio stations, we don't really need the BBC anymore, and then what's going to happen is people like us are going to find that there's no funding.
Well, there is no funding, is there, for us? Let's face it, not in terms of that other broadcasters would recognise. I think the BBC has actually deteriorated over the years. It doesn't do the investigative journalism it used to do. The Panorama programme upon the role of the British Army in terrorism in Northern Ireland of a few months ago was a flash in the pan of the past power of the BBC to carry out proper investigative journalism, because I think that's the big difference between, you know, a comment style broadcasting like we're doing and real investigative journalism, which puts people, you know, gumshoes to work. Donal McIntyre was the Northern Ireland journalist who did the work on that Panorama programme, which pretty firmly pointed the finger at the British Army for hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. Nobody else is doing that. And, of course, if the BBC wasn't there, nobody else would be doing it at all.
Lord Hall addressed the Media and Telecoms 2016 and Beyond conference. It's a nice snappy title, isn't it? Saying he welcomed a transparent and independent process in deciding the future governance of the corporation. But the fact of the matter is the Cameron government wants to start appointing the operational this is a board of directors, effectively. And what Tony Hall's worried about is that these people will make some big editorial decisions, for example, about who individuals who are editors and who's doing it, and also about whether channels live or die.
Well, indeed. I mean, the problem with the BBC is that it's not directly government funded, because, as we all know, it's funded through the licence fee, but the government determines the licence fee. So,
well, what Tony Hall said is effectively he thinks the licence fee payers should be deciding who runs it, rather than government ministers.
Well, indeed, but even if that's the case, and of course they're trying to water that down, even if it were the case that the licence fee payers were to be on the board or whatever, the licence fee itself is not independent of the government. The government decides what the licence fee is going to be, so if they're not happy with the BBC for whatever reason, then they just threaten to reduce their licence fee and move them into the private sector. And of course, you know, people like Murdoch simply don't want the BBC to be there at all. They regard it as an obstacle to their desire for a so-called free market in information, which means that basically Murdoch's views are the only views.
When it comes to appointing the members of the new unitary board, Tony Hall says, the BBC's editorial board, we will be arguing for a transparent and independent process at arm's length from the government. And he's also saying that he welcomes the idea, but he said he's concerned about plans that the chairman, the vice chairman and the four non-executive directors on this proposed BBC board would be government appointed. It just start to sound like that would become a state broadcaster, doesn't it? And at the moment we're in a situation where we get very few articulate voices like yours, for example, Martin, on the BBC. I'm not sure when you were last invited on to speak on the BBC, but we don't hear a very good critique, I think, from the left generally. And this looks to me as if it would then start to just purely become a government mouthpiece. Now, we know in other parts of the world, at the moment, Turkey, this is what broadcasting is all about. It's a mouthpiece of the establishment.
Well, let's face it, all broadcasting involves political decisions. Very few broadcasters are truly independent. Everybody's got a point of view. But the problem is, of course, that the BBC, in theory, is supposed to give a spread of views and give everybody a fair crack of the whip. In practice, they don't. But of course, they are better than the private sector, where, in fact, they don't necessarily give any free views at all. I mean, basically, Murdoch Television gives you Murdoch's views, and that's just about it.
Okay, I'm going to give you free rein now. How do you think that this could be done and should be done to make it actually representative of all the views of the public?
Well, I mean, in principle, what the BBC are doing is not wrong. The idea that it should be funded through public taxation, which is what the TV licence fee actually is, but that it should be independent of government, is in principle the right idea. But of course, the problem with that is that the government is never going to be happy with a broadcaster which they don't control. And although they may pay lip service to the idea that they want to have, you know, fair criticisms made of them, in practice, certainly during election campaigns and run-ups to wars and so on, the BBC does indeed become a mouthpiece for the government of the day, because they do ultimately control the purse strings. And I'm afraid the BBC has been caught out in recent years of basically making stuff up in order to help the British government to pursue its policies, for example, in Libya and Syria, where the BBC have been pretty complicit in specific instances of fabricating news stories, for example, about the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta. There's still been no proper accounting for the fact that they said that the Assad regime carried out the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, but it turned out that they didn't. And the BBC has never, you know, what happens is that just disappears down the memory hole, and most people have forgotten the evidence that came out there,
Martin,
was.
What puts me into a blind rage about this particularly is Libya, because we had the two documentaries which were shown on British television. One was called Murder in St. James, about the killing of Yvonne Fletcher, where the finger was very firmly pointed at the Western intelligence services of deliberately murdering this policewoman. To make it look as if the Libyans had done it, where it's actually the bullet had come from a completely different part of the square, which was being rented by either, I think it was the British or the US intelligence services. Mm-hmm. And the other one, of course, is the Maltese Double Cross, about the Lockerbie bombing, which also showed that it was very unlikely, if not impossible, that the Libyans were even involved with Lockerbie. So the broadcasters play a great role, don't they, in actually building up a case for some kind of what effectively is a criminal, illegal war, an invasion. It's a propaganda outlet.
Well, I mean, both those TV documentaries you mentioned were shown on Channel 4. And I think that is significant. The BBC generally shies away from that kind of control.
It would never repeat it, were they? But I mean, no. And also there's a large question about whether that sort of thing would ever even get made today, let alone be shown.
Well, that's right. I mean, in the past, investigative journalism, and we've had a fairly serious discussions with investigative journalists on this programme, does investigative journalism get done anymore? And, of course, real investigative journalism is incredibly time-consuming and quite expensive, and you have to do an awful lot of research in order to produce a tiny amount of output, because it's all got to be absolutely 100% before you can put it on, terrestrial mainstream TV. And, of course, it's all very well having lots of comment out there on the internet and blogs and so on, but it's not the same as actually carrying out proper
investigations. What we've got is worse. It's in the opposite direction. It's actually propaganda that looks as if it's been thoroughly researched, but actually
indeed,
they're lying to you.
Well, indeed, the problem with the BBC brand is that because they've got a brand for, a reputation around the world as being relatively unbiased, when they do lie, their lies are incredibly powerful. And that, of course, is the real goal of, from the intelligence services' point of view, of having the BBC. And in a way, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. The BBC is by no means perfect, and in actual fact, at crunch points, crucially, seems to be influenced by Foreign Office, MI6, whatever, over things like the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta. But nevertheless, they are far superior to the rabid, opinionated rabble-rousing that goes on TV in the United States of America, for example.
What about Sky? How would you see them fitting into?
Well, I mean, they are basically Murdoch's vehicle for Murdoch's political views. It's that there's no sense in which these are independent broadcasters.
Also this week, I noticed the European Central Bank, moving on to the financial world, has decided they want to do some more quantitative easing, more injection of heroin into the dying patient that is the Eurozone.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very interesting. A few years ago, of course, the German Bundesbank was absolutely opposed to any kind of quantitative easing. They regarded it as heresy, basically, at the same time as the British and the Americans were jacking up full-on mainlining quantitative easing. But of course, the resistance of the Bundesbank to quantitative easing has been worn down.
I mean, I've noticed by
the fact that the economy is simply not recovering. So they've decided to give the Anglo-American drugs a try, and really not just give them a try. What was significant this week is they went for a big hit of quantitative easing, not just a small one.
I noticed there's completely contrary headlines, because obviously the markets have been going up. I was going to say up and down, but actually it looks like down then up, because yesterday the BBC was reporting European Central Bank stimulus surprise sends stock markets sliding. Today, everything's rosy in the garden. European Central Bank bazooka blasts stocks higher. So with an initial depression in the stock markets, suddenly it's gone up again today.
Well, the fact is that the purpose of quantitative easing is to boost the stock market. That's all it's there for. There's no evidence to suggest that it actually helps the mainstream economy. So what they're doing is using, against the textbook and against against the German constitution, they are using quantitative easing to prop up the stock market and the banks, and particularly, of course, Deutsche Bank, which is probably the most exposed bank in the world, which is why the Germans have suddenly decided that they are prepared to take some heroin, because it's probably their bank, Deutsche Bank, which is going to fall first. But nevertheless, I think the fact that they are using such heavy drugs, as it were, indicates that the patient is really in terminal decline. When somebody's dying, it doesn't matter how much heroin they take. And that's pretty much what this bounce in the market is entirely based on expectation that the quantitative easing will lead to a surge in the stock market. Therefore, it does. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But in actual fact, it's a sign of the desperation of the people in charge, because they really have run out of options here. They really don't know what else to do other than get some more heroin and hope for the best.
They're saying that it's far higher than they thought it was going to be necessary. I mean, you would
think...
Is that
a good or a bad sign?
That, well, you would think that some of this money would trickle down into the real world.
No,
why doesn't
it?
Because actually, if you look at the real economy, it's still sliding. Wages not climbing. We've got more and more people, we hear this week, than ever on zero-hour contracts.
Yeah, I mean, the point about quantitative easing was it was a political choice to bail out the banks, the speculators and the financial markets, rather than pursue an old-fashioned policy of government intervention through creation of new infrastructure and training for ordinary people. So they didn't want to do that, because that would have actually led to an economy which would step by step have become much less market-oriented and much more government-led. And because we couldn't do that, because we're not allowed to do that, because that's forbidden, even though we did it for years and years and years and it worked very successfully, so they've pushed quantitative easing as a means of trying to keep the bankrupt banks solvent, keep the show on the road, and avoid having to actually make the really difficult decisions about investment in people and in infrastructure, which would be necessary if you really wanted to tackle the problems. So I don't see this quantitative easing as a positive thing, and I don't see the stock market rising as a positive thing, because the point about all of this is that when they do crash, as a result of all of the quantitative easing and the debt bubble that's been created, the crash will be that much more catastrophic than it otherwise might have been. So it's very, very dubious.
Now, I hope we're joined on the line now by Charles Lucas. Charles, are you there?
Tony, hi, I am.
Charles, we're just discussing, maybe you'd like to chip in on this, whether it's been wise for the European Central Bank to have another great dose. I mean, I've been looking through, it's very difficult to actually find out how much money they've printed this week, and what it means for the Eurozone, and if anything, what it means for us here in Bristol.
Obviously, I'm sorry, I've come into this conversation halfway through, so forgive me if I repeat things you've already said. It seems to me as though it was a bit of ill-thought-out, possibly, idea, or an idea they've been cooking for a very long time, and the European Central Bank suddenly decided to get printing. We've suddenly got a huge stimulus. It shocked the markets yesterday, but from what I saw earlier this afternoon, they've recovered today. So I'm not enough of an economist to tell you what the long-term effect will be, except that I'm extremely uncomfortable with it all.
Are you pleased where we're out of the Eurozone, that we've still got the pound?
Very much so. I think we just need to have looked at the last few years, the European economy full stop. I mean, our economy is in much better shape than a lot of the European economies, and I am very, very glad that we never got involved with the euro.
What's your position on the referendum then?
I thought that might be coming. But like a lot of people, I think my position has changed a number of times in the past couple of years. But whilst I do think the Prime Minister negotiated as good a deal as he could have done from the Germans and the whole of Europe, but he negotiated the best deal he could. I think I personally, at this moment, would vote out if the referendum was tomorrow.
Well, I'm afraid it's Mark Carney that's going to be... We're going to hear from him in a second, the Governor of the Bank of England. He doesn't, it seems, agree with you, although that's not his official position. And he spoke on Channel 4 News just a couple of days ago. And that was, I think, their political editor, Gary Gibbon, that reported it. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, a local Conservative MP, was also on the committee that was grilling the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney. So let's have a listen to a little excerpt from Gary Gibbon's report now.
Big name endorsements don't get bigger than this. The Governor of the Bank of England isn't taking sides in the in-out referendum on Europe, but his words today will only be appearing on one side's leaflets. Mark Carney's view is that he must set up emergency loans for banks to be on standby if a possible leave vote provokes investor panic withdrawals from banks around the time of the referendum. In a letter to MPs, the Governor said the EU had helped prosperity in the UK. Leaving could see city bank jobs go abroad. He also pronounced David Cameron's EU renegotiation a success in terms of what he'd hoped could be achieved. Some pro-leave MPs were unimpressed.
It is speculative and beneath the dignity of the Bank of England to be making speculative pro-EU comments.
I'm not going to let that stand. The language we've used in the report, the language we use in the letter, is careful. It's not conclusive. It's arguable. It's likely.
There are these long pauses.
It's expected.
There are these long pauses between each word that do strike me, actually, as the efforts of somebody who might easily have made a career as a bomb disposal expert.
But the governor repeatedly balanced his language, saying membership of the EU brought its own risks, but Britain leaving the EU could bring significant economic challenges.
It is a risk to domestic financial stability, and it has some potential to amplify pre-existing risks to financial stability.
That was the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, there speaking to one of the Commons committees this week with Jacob Rees-Mogg, local Conservative MP, and I think it's Andrew Tyrie as well, as the chairman of the committee. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is this part of Project Fear? As far as I can remember, the British economy has been sliding and sliding and sliding ever since we joined the EEC, European Economic Community, back in 1973.
Well, I think that's slightly exaggerated, Tony. I mean, the British economy is several times bigger than it was in 1973. Well, so although it's been sliding over recent years.
Okay, I'm looking at whether we actually produce things, make things.
Oh, well, that's a bigger question. I think that I think Jacob Rees-Mogg has got a point here. Mark Carney has, in fact, made a political statement under the table, as it were, in support of the Prime Minister, really, I suppose. But previously, of course, he's actually on the record as saying that there was no evidence that there would be any problem with Britain leaving the EU. And therefore, you've got to ask the question, why has Mark Carney changed his tune? And the stuff I've been reading this week suggests that Mark Carney, of course, is an ex-Goldman Sachs employee, and that they make money, these speculators and traders, on inside knowledge of the kinds of things that central bankers are going to say. So I think there is I think Jacob Rees-Mogg was right to question what Carney's up to there. Not that I'm actually going to vote to stay in, so I'm not making that point in order to try and get at Mark Carney as such.
Charles, what do you make of the comments there? Do you think it's Jacob's right to be criticising the Bank of England governor, saying, hang on a minute, you've got to do what we tell you?
This is all part of the Project Fear to which you referred, and the Prime Minister's team moving to create that establishment is all in the Remain camp, and I agree entirely with the earlier comment that Mr. Carney has breached that position of independence, and one of the great things that's been done in recent years in the London money market is maintaining of the Bank of England independence, and for Mr. Carney to come out with these political comments is a huge error of judgment on his behalf. I commend him for being prudent and being prepared to pump money in if it's necessary. But until we know the result, until we know the way the markets react, it would be wrong for him to cast any opinion either way, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, I would make the point that actually Mark Carney's one of the people who's responsible for the 2008 crisis in the first place, Martin, as he was working at the Bank for England. I mean, lots of people have been convinced to think about him as someone who was from the Bank of Canada, but actually a much more important job he had was sitting on two very important global financial regulation committees at the Bank for International Settlements over in Switzerland. And so, I mean, isn't what he's saying effectively, people will be looking at what Mark Carney's there saying there, Martin, and actually possibly thinking to themselves, well, actually, I don't really trust this guy.
Well, it's not just that he's not just worked as an international civil servant. He's also been an investment banker, or in fact, if we can call it that, for Goldman Sachs, which is supposedly a bank, although it's actually a hedge fund.
Let me just correct you on the civil servant thing, because the Bank for International Settlements is not run by the Swiss government at all. It's a central bank of central banks.
Well, indeed.
Those banks are private banks.
And, well, some are and some aren't. Bank of England is supposedly a nationalised bank, nationalised by the Labour Party in 1946. The Federal Reserve in the United States of America, much less arguably a public bank, in actual fact controlled by private interests. But I think this is a minefield, obviously, and when any central bank governor saying anything is they're supposed to say as little as possible, because markets can move on the things they say. And what I think is interesting about Carney is, in the past, he's on the record as saying that there's probably no implications for Britain one way or the other of leaving the European Union. And on this occasion, he's changed his tune. The question has to be, why?
Well, we've heard from Martin which way he's going to vote in the referendum, and from Charles Lucas from the Conservatives on the line. What about a question, well, we know how David Cameron's going to vote, but will he resign if the country votes to stay in for Brexit? So let's have a listen now to one of the shortest questions I've ever heard from Wednesday's Prime Minister's Questions at Westminster.
Richard Bergen!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If the British people vote to leave the European Union, will the Prime Minister resign, yes or no?
No. Martin, that was very, very quick, short and sweet. Some of them go on for quite a long time. Would it be credible for Cameron to stay on if he's led the campaign to stay in the EU and everyone votes no, or the majority vote no?
Well, he said what he's flagging up is his intention to stay on, although I understand his position is that he doesn't intend to stay on till the next election. But I think he will find his party management quite tricky. If he loses the referendum and says he wants to stay on, others will probably have different views.
OK, Charles, what do you make of this? Could Cameron stay on if we vote for Brexit?
I think we'll have to look at that when the time comes. My concern about the whole referendum campaign is the unnecessary infighting that might well be caused within our party. And I hope that the Prime Minister does choose to stay on and is in a position to do so. We'll have to wait and see what damage he's done between now and then.
Okay, listen, Charles, I'm going to have to ask you to try and find somewhere a little bit closer to a mobile phone tower, or else find a landline and ring us in again, because you're breaking up a bit there. Anyway, let's move on. I don't know if you can hear me okay, let's move on to a more local story. In the Bristol Post, MP Luke Hall is accused over the Tory battle bus election expenses. Conservative MP has been accused of failing to properly declare election expenses. Daily Mirror reported that Thornbury and Yate MP Luke Hall was one of 24 Tories who did not account for a visit from the party's road trip battle bus, which cost £2,000 a day to run during last year's general election campaign. The battle bus visited a host of marginal seats in the run-up to the general election and arrived in South Gloucestershire on the 30th of April, 7 days before polling day, to canvass for votes. Charles, I have to put this to you, because it does seem as if this has been happening in many parts of the country, that the Conservative Party has possibly even broken the law with regards to electoral funding in some constituencies by saying that something is centrally funded, whereas actually it's been helping out in local campaigns, particularly in marginal constituencies. And nobody wants to see any party spending more than they're allowed to in those, particularly in those marginals.
I couldn't agree more. And all I'll tell you is that the Conservative Party, as I'm sure all the other parties, take sticking to the rules of the election rules, and particularly funding, everybody pays huge amounts of attention to them. And this sounds to me like a genuine oversight in the fact that nobody would actively seek to get their funding submission incorrect, or to spend too much money, as you put it. And I would suggest that the local association or whoever organised this particular event to which you're referring felt that it was a centrally funded activity, and the central funding outfit thought it was a locally funded outfit, event, and therefore it's one of those unfortunate errors. But I don't know any specifics about this, so cannot comment with any degree of certainty. All I would say to you is that all politicians from whatever party go to a great deal of trouble to try and get this right, so I'm absolutely sure that there was nothing intentionally fraudulent about this.
Now, they also go to a lot of trouble to win in marginals, and it does look as if, I don't know if you've seen the reports on Channel 4 News by Michael Crick over the last few weeks, that there was a definite effort from Tory Central Office to send both individuals, leaflets, election materials to those marginal constituencies, which were then subsequently not included in that area's election expenses. And I mean, that potentially is fraud.
I can't comment. I haven't seen the reports on Channel 4 News, and I, to my knowledge, that hasn't affected any of us here in Bristol, any of the constituencies, however marginal. So I can't comment. I don't know. But I repeat what I've just said to you, Tony, and that is that all politicians go to a great deal of lengths to avoid this sort of error, and I'm sure that will have applied to throughout the Conservative campaign for the election, and I dispute what you're telling me because I don't know anything to the contrary.
I think the bigger question here is about funding in general. I mean, obviously, the specific allegations are specific allegations which will have to be looked at by the relevant people. But I think there is a question mark underlying funding for political parties. We've got the removal of short money in the House of Commons for opposition parties. And also...
What's that? What are you talking
about? Well, this is money that's made available to opposition parties to, you know, help them get their case across. And the government has cut it back recently. And they've also, you know, the trade union bill will make it more difficult for the unions to fund the Labour Party, which will mean, you know, the next election will be, you know, with a very unlevel playing field from a funding point of view. But the bigger question is, how much money do we want in politics at all? And in the US, of course, you've got one model where any amount of money can be chucked at the process by, you know, multimillionaires like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and so on. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got places like Norway where all political parties are funded directly by the government and no other money is allowed in election campaigns, which makes their campaigns rather boring but very cheap. And I think if we are going to get a very unbalanced setup in Britain where certain parties, you know, obviously the Tory party are going to have a lot more money than all the others, how fair is that in the long run and how sustainable is that in the long run?
Charles, are you comfortable in being in a party which gets so much of its funding from people like the healthcare lobby, for example, who are involved in lobbying really to get rid of the National Health Service so people have to go to private health insurance?
Well, as you well know, at a local level, we end up pretty much funding our own campaigns here in Bristol, and with very little support. Certainly, no, we don't get funded by any large organisation at a local level. So I can't comment specifically in respect of the question. But what I would say is, for you know, the money that the Conservative Party get from significant private or corporate donors, we don't have the benefit of the trade unions, which obviously the Labour Party do, and the Labour Party are funded to a massive extent by the trade unions. And that filters down to a local level. So I think the system's worked up to now. I do agree a proper review would only be a good thing, and I think that would, I'm sure people from all parties would think that, and I would certainly support a thorough review of political funding in this country. But what the correct answer is, I don't know.
Now, Charles, you've sort of catapulted into the middle of the show here on the phone, and you're standing for mayor. I just wondered if you could just tell us a bit about your background, what kind of qualities, I suppose, you bring to a role of running the city. Because now, once someone gets elected a mayor, as we found out with George Ferguson, they're virtually a dictator for 4 years.
Well, You used that word, not me. As you well know, I'm a sitting councillor on Bristol City Council in the Conservative group. And yes, you're absolutely right. You can, and I've experienced it, where the council can vote 70 votes one way and to zero, and the mayor can come along and vote one way or the other, and his vote wins. And that, to me, is wrong. And as part of my campaign, I will be introducing a policy to address this. But all in all, you know, I am the only candidate beyond the incumbent that has any experience of the council and how it works. And I would stress to you that for anybody who's had any connections and dealings with the council, it is a very strange organisation and operates in very curious ways. And in my opinion, one of the qualities that I can bring to the role is that I understand how the council works, or dare I say it, how it doesn't work in part, and how we can put it right. I was privileged to serve as a cabinet advisor for a year last year, and in the last municipal year, I should say. And I learned a great deal of how Bristol City Council works or doesn't. So that's one of the qualities I would like to bring, is that I have an experience of how the council operates.
What about your professional background?
Well, I suppose I should call myself self-employed, but I have business interests primarily outside of Bristol. But I have worked for myself, and I've experienced good times and bad times. And then for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been heavily involved in the Conservative group here in Bristol.
Can I drill down a little bit into what your business interests are? What kinds of business? I mean, that could mean a million things.
Okay. I have property companies. I develop property outside of Bristol. Primarily in the Midlands, and I also have a hobby business, which is a great passion of mine, and that's a wine business.
Well, look, I mean, that's it's brilliant that you have, in a way, because property is, and the price of it, and housing particularly, and rent, is one of the major, major issues right across the city. I can almost feel people listening in their cars out there saying, well, yes, you know, I'm paying far too much for the place that I'm trying to buy. The house prices for new build, I mean, they call them affordable. I look at the price, I think that's not affordable. And so what would you be doing as mayor to make sure that we start to get a bit of a more realistic housing market, where people don't feel they're being taken for a ride, and it's basically a housing racket where they're being charged loads more just simply because landlords can?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about rental or to rent, or rental or to buy, because obviously the way you mentioned, you were talking about affordable housing, and you were talking about buying housing, and then you drop the word landlord into it, which obviously is
well. I think for most people, it's both.
If I could finish,
Charles,
okay.
It's both.
Okay, if both, I'll address both. But you know, the point is that fundamentally, there is a huge shortage of housing in Bristol for all the people who want to live here. Okay, and that is why we have increased homelessness on our streets, which is obviously absolutely wrong in a city like Bristol in 2016. We have. We haven't built enough houses in the last year, decade or even longer. And as a result, we overall, the latest figures show that we need to build 85,000 by 2036. Well, that is a huge number of houses. The current mayor, when he came in, pledged to build 2,000 houses. He's built 11 council houses so far while he's been in office. We need to have a massive, massive investment in housing in Bristol. And fundamentally, the reason both the rental prices and the price to buy a house in Bristol have rocketed are very basic. It's very basic economics. It's supply and demand. We have too few houses, and we have more people wanting to live here than we have homes to live in. And so, therefore, we need to build a huge number of houses very rapidly. We need to look at various ways of speeding up the housing process. We need to resource the planning department to a suitable degree, so that if you deliver a planning application that is complete, that they get a determined planning application in the government guidelines, which currently is obviously 8 weeks. We need to look at other forms of construction, such as modular construction, which is so much quicker. Rather than the average of 30 weeks to build a house, And that's a competitive private builder can build in approximately 30 weeks. Modular construction can be done in a far shorter time. And so we just need to build a whole load of houses, whether they be one bed flats, two bedroom flats, three bedroom houses, four bedroom houses. We need to build housing right across the scale. And we need to also build, some of those need to be affordable. We also need to build more council houses. And there are a whole load of different ways that we can look to do that. And fundamentally,
okay, that
is the biggest objective of any incoming mayor will be to address the housing crisis in Bristol and also the transport crisis.
So, assuming it's you, where would you get the money from to build these council houses? We keep hearing lots and lots of people at the city council, particularly politicians, want to build them, but where are they going to get the money from? Where would you get the money from?
Okay, well, the Conservative Party is ahead of you on this then. We, in the latest budget around, we secured £9 million capital funding that was supported and is part of the incumbent's budget that, to set up a housing delivery vehicle. And the idea is there that we offer along the lines of, if you like, the Bristol Waste Company, which is an independent company within Bristol City Council, which I'm sure you've talked about many times on your programme. But this Bristol Housing Delivery Vehicle would be a company that would wholly owned, independently owned by the council, using the £9 million that we've earmarked to start it off. And we would go out and we would use Bristol City land where we could. We would also involve in joint ventures with other developers to build houses. There will be an element of council housing within all of it, which we would retain for council housing use. Others would be sold at a profit to generate more money to build more. And it's a self-perpetuating model. So in other words, we would become far more commercial and almost private sector in the way we went about it, but with the idea that we would build a certain number of houses, of which a percentage would be retained as council housing, some would be sold as affordable housing, some would be sold as private housing, with a view to generating profit so that we could continue to build more.
Well, sounds like a great plan, but I mean, I wonder if you've seen as part of your job in property, Charles, that people seem to be investing in property just simply because it's somewhere to stash their money, almost like putting it in the bank because they're worried about banks being unstable. Well, we heard from Mervyn King last week, the former governor of the Bank of England, that he believes that it's inevitable that there's going to be a crash, not a bailout next time, possibly a crash. And so it may be that people are putting their money into property because they know that if there is a crash, it's likely to fall far less in value. It will fall, but not so much as if it's if it's there either in stocks and shares or in the bank.
Well, that's the beauty of a free market, isn't it? People can put their money where they want to.
But the problem being is that many of us need somewhere to live, and we would rather that we had, you know, there seems to be a fantastic amount of demand to purchase housing and property, whereas many people can't get.
And when I'm elected mayor in May, Tony, we're going to encourage developers to come along and build houses. And when you build a lot of houses in any one place, i.e. in Bristol, what happens? As the supply is met, demand reduces, and so prices no longer increase at the dramatic rates that they are now. And this is an absolutely critical point of what we've got to do. The only way to address this housing shortage in Bristol is by building a hell of a lot of more houses and promptly.
I'm very glad to hear you say that the council houses are as part of the mix that you are considering, and I think that there is a consensus in Bristol that there has to be some, if you like, social housing provided, and I think Conservatives that we've had on this programme over the years have always consistently taken that view. But as you know, some people have an ideological problem with this. I think that we've got to be less ideological about it and recognise that all useful mechanisms for getting people housed should be used. And I'm glad to hear that you mentioned building council houses, and I'd just like to hear you repeat it because it makes me feel good.
Well, I'm delighted to say, and it's very nice that we're in agreement, that as mayor of Bristol, if I am elected in May, I will be looking to build thousands and thousands of new houses, of which a percentage will be council housing. What my great concern at the moment and is not about the delivery of council housing, but of the delivery of social housing, affordable housing, whatever you want to call it, because we do need that element of the housing stock. But under as now, housing associations are not as well funded as they were, and the whole social housing model is sort of not as secure as it was. I think council housing is a better option than social housing, and that is something we're going to have to talk to developers about as part of my proposals following the election in May. But absolutely, I'm very pleased to confirm on the radio with you this evening that I will be looking to build a whole load of houses, and a percentage of them will be council housing, be retained by the council in order that everybody can live in a warm, dry home.
Well, we've heard hopes and fingers crossed and promises like that before, Charles, so let's hope you can deliver it.
You haven't heard them from me before, because I haven't been in a position to deliver them. If the people of Bristol give me that opportunity, then you can give me a couple of years, and then you can have me back on, and you can quiz me then. But I hope I will have delivered by then.
The MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith, was on Prime Minister's Questions this week, and she was asking the Prime Minister on Wednesday about apprenticeships.
Aaron Smith.
People in Bristol South look forward to their share of the government's promised 3 million apprenticeships, but they question how this is going to happen. On the eve of National Apprenticeship Week, can the Prime Minister tell us, does he have a delivery plan? Or is he making it up as he goes along?
We achieved 2 million in the last Parliament. We're confident of achieving 3 million in this Parliament. We do have a delivery plan. It's based on large companies continuing with their plans for apprenticeships. We want small companies to do more. We want the public sector to join in with larger apprenticeship plans. And we regularly review progress towards the target.
Well, I mean, if you're asking me, I think the Prime Minister's question time is not a very good mechanism for getting any kind of sensible discussion going. Karen is just saying, have you got a delivery plan? And the Prime Minister is just saying, yes, he has. At least we're all in favour of apprenticeships. But the argument is about whether it's actually being put into practice. I suppose that's more constructive than just everybody calling everybody else a fool, isn't it?
I mean, one of the main criticisms, Charles, of the government's apprenticeship scheme since 2010 really has been that it's been used as an excuse by employers just simply to hire people on low wages.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think as you heard, the Prime Minister said in his response to Ms. Smith's question that in the previous Parliament we delivered 2 million apprenticeships. The plan is to deliver another 3 this Parliament. That's 5 million apprenticeships. That is giving people a leg up, if you like, a start in forging a career. And that can only be a good thing. I don't care which party you're part of. That is absolutely a good thing. And through the apprenticeship levy and other things, these are being funded. So these are getting people, if you like, out of unemployment, giving them an opportunity to start a career and to go out and make a better life for themselves. To me, this is a win-win situation for everybody. And the government does have a plan. It is beginning to deliver. And we need to only accelerate it. And so, of course, we need, we all know that everybody needs more money. All these schemes need more money than the government has got, because we are still dealing with the legacy of Ms. Smith's party's mismanagement of the economy up till 2010. I don't want to get into that, but this is the situation. I mean, we don't have a bottomless pit as a country anymore to spend. We have a finite budget. That budget has to be spread over many different things, and part of it is the government's apprenticeship scheme, which is working, because as you've just heard, we're on the way to creating 5 million apprenticeships over the last Parliament and this current Parliament.
Sunday was Mother's Day, and this came up at Prime Minister's Questions too this week.
To Roberta Blackman Woods.
Mr. Speaker. On Sunday, we celebrated Mother's Day and just yesterday, International Women's Day. And members opposite rightly were keen to celebrate women on both occasions. Why then has this government introduced cuts to public services, a freeze to child benefit, and reductions in work-related benefits that have left mothers £13 billion worse off?
The one thing I share with the Honourable Lady is it was right to celebrate Mother's Day. I shared it with my mother, but I think I probably said enough about her for the time being. What I would say is, it was a privilege to welcome to Number 10 yesterday some inspirational women from all walks of life to mark International Women's Day. Now, I'm not saying this government has solved all of these problems, but we've got more women in work, they're getting higher pay, they're paying lower taxes, they're getting more childcare, and they're retiring with better pensions. And when it comes to the things that government needs to do, actually, we're appointing more women to senior positions, to public appointments. The honours system is now properly reflecting women. Someone shouted out, what about the pay gap? The pay gap is now at its lowest published level. We have abolished the pay gap for the under 40s. And when it comes to protecting women, this is the government that criminalised forced marriage. This is the government that introduced the duty to report female genital mutilation. This is the government that set out a specific domestic violence measure. All of these, we introduced Clare's Law so people can find out about violent partners. I accept there's more to be done, but let me say this to the Labour Party. One thing you could help with: no more segregated political meetings. Let us end the process of having people with bigoted religious views treating women as second-class citizens. I think you should all take the pledge: no more segregated meetings.
Charles Lucas from the Conservatives, I wonder what you make of that, because the original question was about the course of the next Parliament, that mothers will actually be £13 billion worse off under the benefit changes that the government have brought in.
Tony, I've already answered both those questions already. I haven't, but the Prime Minister answered the question in great detail, demonstrating ways that we are addressing these issues. And secondly, I repeat what I said in answer to your previous question. We have a fundamental shortage of money in the country because we are putting right the economy. And we cannot just spend money we haven't got. The previous government did that for far too long, which is why we're in the position we're in now. So we cannot carry on just spending money. The government is addressing the issues, as the Prime Minister highlighted in your piece there.
For Martin to respond here.
Sorry, of course.
This is the fundamental nub of the matter, isn't it? The money that isn't there, and the overspend by the previous Labour government. Now, in actual fact, there's no evidence that the previous Labour government did overspend. In fact, they spent rather less than previous Tory governments had done. What happened was that the financial sector, the private financial sector, collapsed, not just into insolvency, but into illiquidity, but into insolvency. And then governments all over the world, including the British government, bailed them out to the tune of billions and billions of pounds. Now, that is why there's no money, not because the government overspent, but because the financial sector, the private financial sector, went down the drain. And it's still, in fact, insolvent. And as the Governor of the Bank of England pointed out last week, there's every possibility that it's going to crash again. And we have basically got a property bubble in the United Kingdom, particularly in the South, which is going to crash when the global economy goes down. And I don't think the Labour Party's got an answer to this, because they're still talking in this silly terms of trying to balance the government's books. And of course, when a crash like that happens, that won't be the case. But the fact is that that's what caused the crash in the first place.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6.